Golden Beach Brands, Inc. v. For Real Foods, 18-1274.
Can I ask a preliminary question?
Without
eating his time.
Do you want me to get him up here first?
No, after they're ready.
Counselor Foster, you reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's wait just a little bit until everybody gets a chance to sit down up here.
Just a preliminary question while you're getting ready. The record appears to indicate that the trial involved chocolate milkshakes, and I was wondering if...
What were you wondering, Your Honor?
Exhibits? Is that what you're looking for? Exhibits?
We didn't get to that point. The patents here are about the rinsing of them, but the district court case involves them. Your Honor, may I begin?
Yes, you may start.
Your Honor, may it please the court. This appeal comes down to whether it would have been obvious to modify a known mixer having a splash shield with a nozzle for rinsing. The secondary references in this case are in the exact same field as the primary reference with the splash shield. Both Miller and Kelly are directed to rinsing components of a mixing machine.
I want to just begin with the APA violation that you allege, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
You say that there's an APA because the PTAB adopted a claim construction not specifically pro-offered by either party, effectively, as you put it, changing theories midstream, and that you didn't have an opportunity to address that. But the when I read the record, I don't find that. Ferriel argued in its patent owner response that it favored the disputed rinse nozzle limitations, including both pre-positioned nozzle and rinsing, quote, directed at the soil surfaces limitation. And Hamilton Beach chose to respond in its petitioner's reply not only to the soiled surfaces aspect, only to the soiled surfaces aspect. And counsel for Hamilton Beach discussed claim construction before the PTAB during oral argument. So how can you argue that Hamilton Beach didn't have an opportunity to respond to a construction that Ferriel offered below?
Your Honor, first of all, there was a structural limitation with respect to the nozzle, the orienting towards the splash shield. And in that one, Ferriel proposed having at least one nozzle oriented towards a soiled area of the splash shield. But then with the method step, they say again, using the nozzle as oriented towards the splash shield. I know they added the word the pre-positioned nozzle, but it wasn't in the original structural.
But within APA, okay, rather than the merits, right? But within APA, are you arguing that it violates the APA for the PTAB to construe a claim that it didn't initially construe in its institution decision?
No, Your Honor. For a couple things. First, it didn't adopt one of the parties' constructions. It slightly took its own construction with respect to the pre-positioned nozzle directed at the splash shield. The second thing is, Ferriel never argued the underlying rationale for the claim construction. If you look at the final decision, the board made a distinction between positionable and oriented, and how those terms should have different meanings. I have no idea what the plain meaning of those terms are. The board gave us no indication of. They just said, in a conclusory matter, hey, they mean the same thing based on the arguments here. They've never gave us any opportunity to respond to that argument. They've never provided what the plain and ordinary meaning of those terms are. I would argue positionable is moving to a specific position. Oriented is just pointing at something. I mean, those terms have different meanings. And that particular rationale, we never got an opportunity to respond to. And it's not something that the patent owner ever raised in the IPR.
So can I ask this? I guess I was remembering that you made an APA argument, which did not
in the form I understood it, bowl me over, about how the adoption of the prepositioned claim construction was procedurally inappropriate because you didn't get a chance to respond to it. And that seemed to me, I guess, not a very strong argument because, as I understood, as to that, what the board did was to take exactly 50% of the proposed construction of the other side. If you're now saying something slightly different, I didn't take this to be an APA argument. I think that there is a concern, at least I had a concern, that when the board got round past the claim construction point to reading the prior art and figuring out what it would have made obvious to a relevant skilled artisan, that the board thought that these claims required that the novel operate automatically and not by hand, and that it be in a fixed position, both of which seem to me to be not so much a matter of late arising as to be possibly, as I take it you are arguing, simply wrong.
Well, Your Honor, when in our briefs, we did argue they changed kind of the story of why they had this construction based on the distinction between positionable and oriented. But then we also argued extensively in the briefs how essentially they narrowed, especially under the broadest reasonable interpretation, they inappropriately narrowed the claim.
Right, but that's not an APA type you didn't give us fair notice argument, as I read your brief, as so much as these claims just do not, this is all about claim 21, right? Am I right? This is, everybody agrees?
It's the only claim.
Right. So that claim simply does not require the nozzle to operate automatically or indeed to be in a fixed position.
Yes, Your Honor. We also argued it was an error of law to construe the claims why they did. This is a claim construction that they would never get in a district court action. In fact, in the pending district court action, this isn't the claim construction.
So you are, in fact, arguing that the board's reason for distinguishing Kelly and for distinguishing the asserted combination, namely that this patent, or that rather claim 21 of the patent at issue, is essentially about an automatic nozzle and a fixed position nozzle, that is wrong, and once you eliminate that error, Kelly teaches it.
Yes, Your Honor, we would argue that. We would also even argue under the board's claim construction, if the court agreed with it, the combination of references still read on a prepositioned automatic rinsing. The board used the wrong standard for obviousness. They used this bodily incorporated standard. They said, I'm looking at the Miller reference, and it teaches manual rinsing of the splash shield, but it does teach automatic rinsing of the spindle. And the board never tried to look at whether or not one of ordinary skill in the art would be able to modify Nielsen, which does have a splash shield.
I just want to ask you, let me follow my point, and then maybe I'll walk away from it. Who cares about automatic? Really? This claim doesn't require it, does it?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
So why is that not, not quite alpha to omega, but alpha to something close to omega of your argument?
Your Honor, it could be because, as you said, Kelly does have a nozzle that's oriented towards a splash shield. And again, one thing that kept happening in this case is that the board kept looking at the references individually. They never looked at what the teaching of the reference were in view of Nielsen. Like, how would you modify Nielsen in view of Kelly's teaching? So if you added Kelly's nozzle to Nielsen's blender, you would have the patent. You would have a nozzle oriented towards a splash shield, and then you could rinse the splash shield with that nozzle. There's no requirement that it be automatic. There's no requirement that it be fixed. And so, Your Honor, we would agree. The only point we made in our briefs is whatever the claim construction is, even if it is fixed, we still show it with our references if you apply the correct obviousness standard. But, Your Honor, we would agree with you that if it's adjustable, Kelly would be enough as far as the nozzle.
You,
it does show up.
You argued that at 26 of the Bluebird, the 661 patent does not even use the term soiled, nor does it define which portions of the claimed splash shield would be soiled. What else would nozzles 34A and 34B be rinsing,
again,
other than a soiled splash shield?
Well, Your Honor, well, one rinses the top, one rinses the bottom. I don't know if the top is, I don't know. It doesn't talk about how it's mixed or what exact portions are. The patent also discusses that those nozzles might not be sufficient to rinse the entire splash shield. It might have to be rotated, for example.
Well, you sort of do know the exact portions because it's a pre-mixed package, right?
Your Honor, the patent talks about using nozzles just on one side. You wouldn't be able to rinse the entire splash shield without actually demonstrating it with a shake. I'm not sure we know is the entire thing covered or not. But again, the patent claim only requires that rinsing fluid be directed onto the splash shield and that there's nozzles oriented towards the splash shield.
I think Judge Wallach really wanted you to bring a mixer and a milkshake.
Right, Your Honor.
I love a good mess.
All right. Let's... Before your time runs out, I do want you to make comment as to the supplemental authority that we've been receiving prior to this argument and the click-to-call type argument here. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. I am aware of the click-to-call case and the Bennett Regulators case. The court has recently repealed the old Principi case where if a case was voluntarily dismissed, that would no longer serve to bar an IPR that was filed a year after the dismissed case. Here it's a little different circumstance. Here there was no standing for the earlier 2014 act.
Why does that matter?
Well, Your Honor, there was never any sort of claim to bring. In the other cases, there was a claim. In one case, they just dropped it on their own, the click-to-call case. The other one, there was a dismissal because of a personal jurisdiction. But again, that can be waived.
What if service is improperly perfected?
Well, I mean, if service was improperly perfected, I guess that's not a served complaint under the meaning of the statute. And here, because there never was any sort of cause of action, I don't know how you can serve a complaint. In fact,
well, one of the things that was sort of strikingly, at least striking to me, missing from the very abbreviated briefing on this whole 315B issue is the kind of exploration of background law that, I don't know, I think literally dozens of pages were filled with analysis in the click-to-call situation to figure out whether the language of 315B implicitly contained or did not contain an exception for a voluntary dismissal. And as far as we haven't been given anything to support your assertion, which maybe has an intuitive appeal, I'm not sure, about why lack of standing, whether it's Article III standing, whether it's you're not a patentee under 281 standing, if that's the right term, bears on the application of the quite strict service rule in 315B. Why does it bear on that?
Well, Your Honor, there was no cross appeal on this point.
That's a separate question, and I think we'll talk. At least I hope to talk to your friend on the other side about that. But
so for purposes of appeal, we assume that the board's decision was going to apply because the patent owner didn't appeal that part of it, and then the board does address it.
No, but you are making the assertion that taking click to call as a given, this is different because for real at the time it brought its 2014 suit and apparently properly served it. There's no dispute about that. Nevertheless, that suit should be – maybe I have the years wrong, but that suit should be disregarded because for real could not properly have brought that suit, even though it in fact asserted this patent against you.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how you can serve a claim that you didn't –
So what law links service, propriety, and standing in the underlying complaint being served? That's my question. You've made the assertion that they're linked, but not supplied us any legal authority at all to tell us whether that's a sound assertion.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, one of the circumstances that might happen. So, for example, the way that the standing issue was discovered was 15, 16 months into this case, when we served the parent corporation of FurReal, after FurReal told us that the documents related to the acquisition were completely unrelated to the case. We discovered these documents on the eve of the Markman hearing. What happened if we did file an IPR in time? We would be fighting an IPR with a party that didn't even own the patents. Would the IPR be null and void?
Despite click to call, is Ohio Willowwood still good law?
Your Honor?
I said despite click to call, Ohio Willowood is still good law, is it not?
Your Honor, I didn't get a chance to brief this issue. I don't know the case. We relied on the Principi case from this court where previously a dismissed complaint didn't count. And as you know, there's been a couple decisions, click to call a couple months ago, and then a few days ago, the Bennett regulators case.
So 315B refers to service of a complaint. And you've been arguing or you've been focusing, and I think that some of our cases focuses on the service part. What about the complaint part?
Well, Your Honor,
do we look at the content of a complaint?
The complaint couldn't plead a cause for patent infringement of these claims because Friel didn't own the patents at the time.
It did plead a cause of action for infringement of this patent, which is the wording of 315B. You have an argument that says, nevertheless, that actual pleading shouldn't count because the plaintiff making the pleading could not properly do so. And my question, I think what we've all been talking about is, how do we know that that is a not that it was improper, but how do we know that 315 should be so interpreted to look back to the propriety of the plaintiff?
Well, again, I think the service of the complaint has to be proper. And if there was no cause of action, I don't know how the service of the complaint could be proper. This was a defect that could not be cured. There was no cause of action. It's a myth. They did not own the patent. I don't know how this seems to create a perverse incentives where anyone can sue.
So is this a case in controversy constitutional issue?
Your Honor, I would say it's a constitutional issue to create, someone could create a bar for Hamilton Beach based on patents they don't even own, and especially given the estoppel provisions of the IPR Act. Your Honor, I'm out of time, unless you have further questions.
Okay, well, we kept you over, so we'll restore your time when you come back up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's hear from Counselor Chambers.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me take you to the end. To start, okay?
The click to call?
Yeah, and particularly that question I asked about Ohio Willowood, which requires the party asserting patent infringement must have legal title. And on the day it filed the complaint, and it can't be cured retroactively. I don't think click to call rejects that position. Did Friel have legal title? And if not, how do you respond?
Well, we found some case law that indicates Friel might have had beneficial or equitable title. This was an honest mistake in preparing the merger papers as set forth in the Erica Frank Declaration, and I can give you the citation to that, which is A-876 through 877. This is supposed to be a reverse triangular merger. There was a staff attorney who didn't understand what a reverse triangular merger was. Actually, neither do I.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. So she prepared this document that shouldn't have been prepared, put it in a big stack, had it signed with all the other documents, and then stuffed it in a drawer. Never got recorded with the patent office. On the face of the patent, it says Friel owns it.
Okay, but at the time that we're looking at, Click to Call was not the owner of the patent.
Well, Click to Call, of course, was not the owner of the patent. But, even if you want to take the position that Friel wasn't an equitable or beneficial owner, and we did find a case, by the way, that said that the parent corporation could be added as a co-plaintiff and then ratify what its subsidiary did and then solve the problem that way. But I think the key point is Click to Call, which said you have an unambiguous statute that is quite clear on its face. The statute doesn't say the complaint has to be in the right court, doesn't say anything about whether there's personal jurisdiction or not, doesn't say anything whether it's subsequently dismissed. It doesn't say anything in the statute about whether the patent owner filed the complaint.
So the argument that there's no circumstances under which click to call would not apply if we have a complaint and we have service. The content and the other procedural aspects of the complaint have no meaning, and as long as the service was okay, then that has no meaning as well.
That's right, Your Honor. You have a
how can that be?
How can that be?
We have a whole jurisprudence on procedure and filing a complaint and pleading the facts of a complaint, and we also have the very constitutionally based standards on standing. If you have no standing to bring a suit, then how can you say that that is a properly served complaint?
Well, then you're getting into the law of service. If you're saying you can't serve a complaint because it's defective on the merits, even if it's defective on the merits on standing, you won't know that perhaps until the end of the case. So you're going to convolute the law of service by saying that you don't know whether you have valid service until
when the court looks at imperfect service or a standing issue, let's say 3-4 months down into a case, even though the complaint's been answered, and now standing comes up and it's shown that there's no standing, does that go back ab initio to the filing of the complaint, or does the lack of standing only apply at that point in time, 3 months into the proceeding?
Well, I think you have different contexts there in terms of whether the court can...
In other words, if there's no standing, is there a complaint?
Yes, there is a complaint.
Have to agree that under the plain language view of 315B you are asserting that there is a bizarre consequence, if that's in fact the correct view, of the sort that Mr. Foster pointed out. Anybody wholly unrelated to the patent can file a complaint asserting against them infringement of this patent, and that starts the one-year clock.
No, I would say, Your Honor, there's other mechanisms in the district court's toolbox which they have to discourage intentional, and remember, this case is not intentional, intentional abuse of process. One of those things in the district court toolbox is Rule 11. To stop recreational litigation.
Can a complaint be a nullity?
Again, I think you have to look at the context. In this context, no. If you have a document that, as it was here, was a professionally prepared complaint with the plaintiff being who
that was a yes or no answer.
As the owner.
That was a yes or no answer. Can a complaint be a nullity?
I would say it depends on the context.
Suppose that there's a company out in some state, and they hire another company to pose as the owner of Penn's, and they sue 30 defendants in that district. And does that provide notice to all 30 defendants as to that particular patent? Does 315 kick in at that point?
Well, it does under the way the statute is lit and the way Congress chose to write the statute. And appellant is asking you to rewrite statutes. That's what Congress.
What I've described is seriously gaming the system.
But
we do see cases all the time where multiple defendants are sued. Okay, suppose someone sues multiple defendants on a particular patent, like let's say a menu patent, and they sue all the restaurants in the area or a bunch of them. Are all of them on notice at that? And the person doesn't own the patent. The complainant does not. The plaintiff does not own the patent.
And,
does that suffice 315B?
It does under the unambiguous wording of the statute. So you have to just – the statute is unambiguous. That's what click-to-call says. And so you just – if you have a simple, unambiguous statute, you just apply the statute as it is. So it's actually a good, simple rule that if you get served with a complaint.
Can I interrupt and just ask you about this cross-appeal question? So even if you were right that they were out of time, the most you could get out of that is not an affirmance of the rejection of their invalidity challenge, but rather, as in Click to Call, an order from us ordering dismissal of the IPR, which would be a quite different judgment, in part, if only because of the quite different estoppel effects. When a judgment would have to be altered and not simply affirmed, the very strong rule, which some courts call jurisdictional and the Supreme Court has repeatedly refused to say whether it's jurisdictional or not, but has said it's very, very strict, you did not file a cross appeal here. Why should that omission in this case be overlooked, forgiven?
Well, I looked very closely at your Aventis Pharma versus Hospira case, in which this court came down very hard on filing cross appeals because of getting extra briefing time.
Well, filing unnecessary cross appeals is a no-no, but filing necessary cross appeals is a requirement.
Can
I suggest that you might want to get to the merits before your entire time runs out?
Yes, okay. But I'll quickly answer a couple questions. The petition was denied and dismissed. So what we're seeking is an affirmance of the denied and dismissed. It's a dead petition. You don't need to keep putting bullets into it by sending it back to the board. And then your point about putting 30 companies on notice, you have Rule 11 to deal with. If you are doing it intentionally and in bad faith, then you're going to be subject to sanctions with Rule 11.
Some folks may consider that a good trade-off. I'll take a Rule 11 sanction, and I'll put 30 companies in this particular jurisdiction.
Right. Well,
I'll put them on notice. They better run down and file their petition within a year.
And as pointed out in the concurrence in Click to Call, they might get their wish and get a lot of IPR petitions filed, so that may not be such a good idea for them to do. So let's get to the merits of the case, because this was a quantum leap in blender technology to have the first self-cleaning blender. And
So what makes this blender self-cleaning under Claim 21? Not your blender. Your blender, terrific. You know, you've conquered the world with your blender because it's automatic, right? But the Claim 21 doesn't say that. Please don't interrupt me. Please. Claim 21 does not say automatic.
Correct.
The board seems to have relied on an assumption that Claim 21 requires an automatic nozzle.
It's Claim 21 is a method claim which is capable of automated operation. It's capable of automated operation.
Where's the claim language that says that?
It doesn't say the words capable of automated operation. It describes a structure and a method which allows automated operation. And this is how it does it. And this is the genius of the invention, which is not present in the prior art. So the inventor, Mr. Farrell, recognized it was all about the splash shield. So you need to do two things with the splash shield. First, you have to put it on top of the cup in a way that covers most of the top of the cup. So you limit the area of splatter to a very small localized area. So you've got it in a small localized area. That's the first big advance. The other big advance is to have a fixed pre-positioned nozzle pointed at that small soiled area. And so after you isolate or remove the cup with the blending, then you use that nozzle to spray the soiled area of the splash shield and clean it off.
Do I understand right? You asked the board to construe the claim to require that the sprayer spray the soiled area, and the board said no, and you haven't appealed that claim construction.
Yeah.
So why are you talking about the soiled area?
I'm talking about
your claim. Your claim does not require that as construed. You got to stop that. The claim does not require under the board's construction, which you haven't appealed, that the spray go to the soiled area.
Correct. The board did not put the word soiled in. The board took a very logical and correct approach in looking at the specification, looking at the way words are used in the claims, and also some of the claim language would be superfluous if it wasn't prepositioned. I'm just explaining how the invention works to allow it to be
right, but you understand my concern. Your machine, which has done spectacularly in the market, involves a bunch of the things that you are describing that don't appear to be in Claim 21.
I'm describing how it works. You're right. Soiled is not in Claim 21. This is the genius of the invention, but it's not in Claim 21. Prepositioned, as the board correctly determined, is in Claim 21. It's there because of how the claim is structured, by saying first that you have this nozzle that's oriented toward the splash shield. So that's the first part, and that becomes superfluous.
And you argue that oriented means fixed.
Yes.
Okay, and the shield, it's fixed to the shield, to clean the shield.
It's towards the shield.
Okay, toward the shield. It's fixed so it sprays the shield.
Yes.
Okay. The shield itself is movable.
The shield
is not fixed.
The shield can go up and down in the preferred embodiment, definitely.
If the nozzle is fixed and the shield is moving up and down, how is it spraying the shield?
Because the shield is moving up and down when it's being blended, and then it actually goes to the down position. You take the cup out that's isolating the vessel, which is actually teaches away in Kelly. Kelly says you don't isolate the vessel.
Let me interrupt you. At that point, the shield is fixed, is it not? Once that,
yeah.
And at that point, soiled or not, it is sprayed. Am I correct?
Yes.
So the word soiled doesn't matter. What happens is it's sprayed every single time, whether it's splashed up or not.
Very good, Your Honor. That's very good. That's very good. But it's the area that's most likely to be soiled, let's put it that way. And that's also kind of a key distinction of Kelly. Is Kelly's, it's a kitchen spring spray nozzle. All three of the references you have to manually move around to get the cleaning.
Counselor, you're out of time, but I'll let you conclude.
Okay. The commercial success is some of the most powerful and compelling evidence I've ever seen in a patent case. You have, in the first year that this blender...
No, I want you to conclude. You're making a new argument. I want you to conclude, or time is up.
Okay.
It's up to you.
So the board did an excellent job with its analysis. I noticed very quickly the counsel said the board used the wrong standard for obviousness. The board used the Graham versus John Deere standard.
Okay, you're making another argument, so you may sit down. Thank you. Counselor Foster, we'll restore you back to your full 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I won't use the whole three. Just a couple points. There's a lot of discussion about the standing issue in this case. I'd like to note that the board actually ruled on the standing issue. It's at Appendix 1267 to 71. So that determination is based on the abuse of discretion standard. The papers show that the original assignment was signed by the president of For Real and someone on the board of Rich Corporation. So the board ruled there was a transfer of ownership, and there was, in fact, no standing. Again, with respect to this genius of invention, this is really what KSR was intended to address. The Nielsen reference does have that splash shield. It does confine the rinsing. And then we have Kelly and Miller. There are different solutions for rinsing devices. One of them, while Kelly can rinse from that.
What evidence did you submit to support the statement that a person of ordinary skill in the art would have, using practical sense in the reality of the world, have made this combination?
Your Honor, we use the declaration of Dr. Alex Slocum, and then if you look in our briefing, during the cross-examination of Dr. Slocum, he goes step-by-step how you combine the three references to arrive at an automatically rinsing blender, because as you know, the patent owner is really pushing for this automatic construction, and during the cross-examination, he was pushing the expert on that issue, and he talked about the teachings of Kelly of more than one nozzle. Kelly teaches that you can close the rinse area. Kelly teaches a sink, and then Miller actually teaches an automatic nozzle.
But your problem is that you had an expert, but the board believed the other expert, and that's a weight of fact.
Actually, Your Honor, the board didn't rely on the other expert. There's no citation whatsoever to Dr. Maines. Dr. Maines only submitted a report with the preliminary response. They did not submit a report afterwards. What the board did, they said Miller teaches manual rinsing of a splash shield and left it there. This is the body of the incorporation that I was previously talking about. It's not that the references need to be physically combinable in the specific way taught. It's what do they teach one area of skill in the art? This is KSR. In KSR, it was pedals and sensors. Here, it's mixing machines and nozzles. And we have two examples of rinsing components in place of a mixing machine. It just happens to be the Nielsen mixing machine has a splash shield. And then just a final point on the standing issue. I think one reason why we're not seeing any law on this point is because normally service is going to be an issue if you have standing. No one's going to challenge the service issue. So I think it's just a new area of law where this is going to be a case of first impression. We did do some research after receiving the second notice of supplemental authority, and just the issue hasn't been ruled upon at all, whether or not a complaint without standing can be served. Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, and yes. I ask the court reverse the decision of the board and in the alternative, remand for further proceedings.
Okay. We thank counsel for their arguments. We will now take these cases under consideration. We're going to go back into the deliberation room for a short period of time. It'll be a short period of time, and then we'll come back out and have a question and answer session on matters that are not related to the cases, okay? So this court now stands in recess.
Yeah, any question that begins, "Why did you ask me?" won't be answered.